It's Nancy Peroso conducting an interview today, which is January 8th, 2014, and the interview is being conducted in Thunder Bay, and I'm going to have our narrator for today introduce herself and her connection to the grain trade.
Well, my name is Jean Morrison, and I don't have that much of a connection to the grain trade, except that I studied at Lakehead University and chose as my MA thesis working class history before World War I. And so how the grain trade naturally fitted into that, since the grain trade was the major business in Port Arthur and Fort William at that time. So I got to look at grain workers, and one thing that really interested me was the grain trimming process. And I had the opportunity to interview many people at the time, and one man was a grain trimmer whose father had been a grain trimmer. So he explained to me the whole process of grain trimming, which was quite a fascinating one to me.
What do you recall about his
Well, I recall him talking about being in the holds of ships and sweeping and shoveling grain. The idea for that was to make sure that ships were properly loaded or balanced so that the ship wouldn't tip over when it got afloat. And it was quite hazardous, for one thing. Grain dust was very strong, and many grain trimmers became ill with lung diseases as a result of that. And another thing he told me, his name was, forgotten the first name, Otway was the last name, and that most of the grain trimmers at that time were from Ireland. They were Irish. Most of the grain handlers, people who worked in the grain elevators at that time, were from Scotland. And that's how you got a job. The foremen were all Scots, and they not only hired Scots, but they hired people from their own locality in Scotland, preferably their own clan. So it was very close-knit. This is before the war, the First World I'm talking about. Now, when the war began, many of the Scots signed up and were in the army. There was a shortage, so they had to hire foreigners. Now, many foreigners, depending what part of Europe they came from, were considered to be enemy aliens. So I don't think they would hire someone from the Austro-Hungarian Empire. So they had a hard time getting jobs. And if they were unemployed and an enemy alien, they were either, well, they couldn't have been deported at that time, but they were put in camps. That's a sidetrack, sorry.
The sidetracks are interesting. Now, going back to, you're not from Thunder Bay originally.
No, I moved here in 1966, and I'd taken one credit towards my master's at Carleton, and then after a couple of years of living here, Lakehead University began its MA program, and I was in the first year of it. And I also had three children at home, so I did one course a year before I started launching into my thesis. And the reason I chose the thesis had nothing to do with the grain trade. It had to do with the fact that on Bay Street, there were two Finnish halls, both considered as labor halls, side by side, and obviously hostile to one another, and how this came about. So that's what I started off with, was the history of the Finns in town. So I thought I would do that, and that was at that time going to focus in the post-World War I era. But then I thought I should maybe start at the beginning of the labor movement. And there was a man, there was a bookstore on Algoma, and Einar Nordstrom, a retired milkman, was Thunder Bay's labor historian. He was a Swede Finn, and he had done all kinds of research on the local labor movement. So he told me about Harry Bryan, the first organizer of unions outside the railway unions, who in 1903 organized the Bridge and Structural Iron Workers Union. They were building elevator number A, B, C, I think C or D. Yeah, elevator D. The first non-railway union was Local 43. He organized them, and then he went on to organize the workers on elevator E. And they had a strike. And he had worked with the American Federation of Labor in Cleveland. He was born in the United Kingdom, but he was raised in Ontario, but had moved to the States for work. And he came back here when he was blacklisted for leading a street railwayman strike. His parents had already moved to the Dorian Herkett area, where they were, you know, had a little log cabin that they lived in. He lived with them. Then he got work himself on this first elevator D. So he organized several unions in town. And another one he organized, which stayed in existence for a long time, was Local 479 of the Grain Trimmers Union in the International Longshoremen's Association. And that union lasted for a long time. It's still in the Longshoremen's Union, but it has a different number now.
I have a question about longshoremen. Do you know the origin of that name?
No, I don't. It's an interesting question, because in some places they're called dockers, dock workers, or navvies, N-A-V-E. It's most longshoremen at the time, they were sort of the lowliest of the low, doing the heaviest of labor, lifting all these packages and freight, you know, out of ships into freight yards or onto carts pulled by horses, I guess, that would go to freight sheds, or moving goods out of freight sheds onto trains. I don't know who did that. But anyway, and in Thunder Bay, most of these freight handlers were from Europe. They weren't the British types. The British types were more in the elevators and the grain business. So, and that was very hard work.
You went on from your master's thesis to actually publish a book.
Yes.
But before I ask you to comment on that, I'd like to come back, just in case I forget, I'd like to come back and talk about just in general those foreigners that you were talking about. So, but following your master's thesis, how did that expand into labor
pits? Well, it took my thesis on the working class, which was Thunder Bay, the working class and its relationships in Thunder Bay before World War One. Well, right after that, I ended up getting a job at the newly founded Old Fort William, which had to do with the fur trade. And you'd think there was no connection, but there was a big connection because of the location. The location of Fort William was the exact site where the freight sheds were built. And all the street names in Fort William's East End are named after the early fur traders. So at the time of the Northwest Company, Fort William was an inland headquarters. It wasn't just a post, it was an inland headquarters of the Northwest Company, from which Canada was explored, you know, all the way to the West Coast. And it made possible the establishment of the future Dominion of Canada. When the railways came and the CPR took over that place, it was the link which made Canada the Dominion of Canada from east to west. So there was a continuity in the purpose of that site. It was really the center of Canada's transportation and the force that kept or made Canada a united entity. So after I retired in 1990, seems like a long time ago, I did this and that, and then I would often give little papers on some aspect of the fur trade. And at one conference, it was a genealogical conference, a publisher asked me to, if I would publish a book about the fur trade. So I did some publications on that. And then the Historical Society asked me if I would think of putting my thesis together as a book. So that turned out to be Labor Pains, Thunder Bay's Working Class During the Wheat Boom Era. That was 2010, yes.
How did the title come about? By the way, it's a great title.
Well, we kept thinking of titles. I don't know if it came to me in the dead of night, but I thought it needed some kind of jazzy title. And I found out, of course, through Google, it's not original. Some other people have used this title in books about the labor movement, but I think they were in the States.
I don't know if you want to answer the question the way I'm going to ask you to, so we can get at the information in another fashion. But reading your book, I had a real sense of what it was like back in those days. And just as a personal aside, my husband's grandfather came over and lived on McNaughton, and worked in the freight sheds.
Oh, for heaven's sake.
So some of the photographs in the book, this is a plug for the book, anybody who's listening to this, are actually McNaughton Street. But and I was looking to see if any of the people in the pictures looked looked like my husband's family. But how do you think about answering this question? Can you put yourself back to the 1880s, into the early 1900s, and assume that you've come to visit Thunder Bay, and you started to come into, and let's use the Cold Dock area, because you were mentioning it as being sort of the East End and where the fort was. Describe what it was like for somebody, you know, from out of town coming. What would they see? What would they smell? You know, what would the buildings be, the people?
Well, I'm going to cough.
No, you have to press the lever again.
Have you asked the question online?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Online.
Here we go.
Well, if I were coming to Fort William back before the First World War, I personally would probably never go into the East End because I am of Anglo-Saxon Scottish descent, and ladies like that would never venture forth. This is where the foreigners lived. Immigrants from Italy, Slovakia, Poland, some Greeks, and the people were living in what we would call shacks. It was low, swampy ground and probably quite smelly. The people were living in these small houses, but they were crowded houses because most of the freight handlers were single men. So one house might have 12 to 13 boarders, and the woman of the house would be looking after feeding them. And the houses all had bake ovens in the backyard. That's where they did the baking, and I don't know where they did the laundry, how they manage. And also, it would have been too shocking for me to see evidences of drinking, because there is a picture, I think, in the book showing beer kegs actually thrown out on the street. Actually, the whole of downtown Port Arthur and Fort William, there were taverns almost in the downtowns on every corner. Drinking was rife. And of course, being a good Protestant, I would never approve of that under any circumstance. So there was really little or no mixing of the Anglo upper middle class types socially and these foreigners.
You mentioned that that was the freight shed area, but it was also the area where the CPR was building their elevators, and Ogilvy would be at the turn of the century.
I think they would have been farther up the river. I think the coal docks were close to the mouth. Now, there was an elevator at the very mouth, I think.
Yes, the Empire.
But most of them were built. If you see a picture of the river at that time, the river would be clogged with ships all the way up as far as that swing bridge that has recently met a disaster, clogged with ships and elevators of all sizes. Mm. Of course, the ships were very small in that time, so. Mm.
The people living in the East End then, a lot of them would be the freight shed workers that you mentioned. Where would the people constructing the elevators live?
The part of the East End, I guess I should have said the coal docks area. That's the area that we now consider across the bridge, but along Simpson Street, not across the bridge, like Bethune Street and those streets, that's where the more Scottish English types of workers lived. I don't know if there was much mixing of the two, but they didn't live in that little pocket on the other side of the tracks.
Who would have been constructing the elevators?
Well, people like Harry Bryan. And these would be people eligible to be members of the carpenters, workers, the bridge and structural iron workers, painters. They would be either from the British Isles or from Canada, and maybe a few Americans. They would be English speaking and eligible for members in what was known as craft unions. And similarly with the railway worker unions, an engineer or a conductor, these were considered the aristocracy of the working class. And many of the railway workers, people became either aldermen or even the mayor. This Peltier I mentioned, L.L. Peltier, had been head of the conductors, brother, order of railway conductors for all of Canada at one time. They were very prestigious and very literate. They may not have gone far in school, but they were well-read people and very political.
The development of... who would the... First of all, how would the immigrants from, you know, from either Northern Europe, including the British Isles and Southern Europe, how would they end up in Thunder Bay at that time?
Well, with the people from, say, Italy, I've forgotten their name, would be kinds of... employment agencies who would round up these workers and bring them in by train in groups, whole groups of people, they would hire them. And this was certainly evident during some of the big strikes in the freight sheds. When they were on strikes, the railways would just go to one of these agents and say, we need several hundred strike breakers that ship them up. And they would come by train and be met at not very favorably when they arrived.
So would those agents then, because I'm thinking of the waves of Finnish and Italian immigrants that came over, would their tentacles reach into Europe as well?
I think the Italians they would. I'm not so sure about the Finnish, whether they came out on their own many of the more educated Finns came as political refugees because there'd been, in 1905, there'd been a sort of mini-revolution, but many Finns had come out during the 10 years or so before, conditions were so bad. A lot of Finns first settled in northern states, Wisconsin and Minnesota, and then found their way up here. The border was non-existent. They came by boat. There was no road in those days, so you'd come from Duluth. To Port Arthur,
so when someone arrived, and let's say this was before, we'll move on to labor strife, the pain part of it. But how did you had five people coming off a boat, let's say, of different nationalities? How did they get settled? Where did they get jobs?
Yes,
did they mesh together, or were they quite separate?
That's an interesting question. They would obviously come by ship either to Quebec City or Montreal if they were coming through Canada, get on a train, and these trains. And how that was organized, I don't know. I know, the benches were wooden, and you'd have to have enough money to get your own food because there were cooking facilities on the trains for the lowest class. Not the other, the middle class would travel and be served in the dining car, but the immigrants didn't have that. Now, many people had the intention of going right across Canada, ending up in the prairies. When they got out at Thunder Bay, Port Arthur, Fort William, for some reason just decided to stay. Depending on the job market, at certain times when in the wheat boom period, it was quite prosperous and jobs were there. Now, whether there was somebody at the train station offering jobs, I have no idea. It's an interesting logistical question, and somebody might know the answer.
My grandfather came from Britain at about the same time with an intention of going to Vernon, B.C.
Oh, really?
He got to Thunder Bay, and he was sick of traveling on the train, and there was a job.
Okay.
So there's one person's story.
As I heard a story, this was in the Depression later, of two guys riding the rails. I think they were from Britain, and they were hungry, and they got out at Fort William Sunday. Well, if we go to a church, maybe someone will take pity on us. And one of them had a fantastic voice. So the choir master went to him after and said, "Join our choir." He said, "I can't. I haven't got a job." "We'll get you a job. You'll stay and sing in the choir." So the family's still here.
Hmm. So we got our five people coming off the train.
Yeah.
And how did they, where did they link up? Where would their nationality have taken them?
Well, if they were Italian, or depending on the national, they would probably have connections. But maybe if they were Italian, they were with a whole group, and their agent would have made connections. They'd end up in some boarding house And the Finns, too, there are lots of Finnish boarding houses, more in the current area around Bay Street. And there was quite a big Finnish community in Fort William, too. There was a Finn Hall in the East End, I think on Robertson Street. I don't know if that building's still there. I doubt it.
And if you were Finnish, where would you usually get your job?
The Finns, some of the Finns were carpenters, so they would, I guess, go to some construction company, or they would, many of them found their way into the wilderness where there were Port Arthur and was surrounded by these little wee communities of Finns living in the bush, and they would be bush workers. And they'd have a little plot of land and be sort of, do some, you know, small farming as well. And then the winter would go and cut wood and off their own lots to begin with. So they were bush workers.
Now, even the bush workers would have a connection with the grain industry. Because one of the other books I looked at just recently was the Timber Wolves.
Oh, yes.
And on the front cover of that is a picture of a grain elevator.
Okay.
And in the foreground are tens of thousands of wooden piles.
Of what?
Wooden piles.
Oh, of course.
That would have been...
Well, that was the... The wood would go to the sawmills, of course, and then be turned into lumber, right?
For the elevators, or the piles which form the foundation.
And also, though, for export. Because lumbering became a major business more after the First World War. I mean, there was lumbering, of course, the people cutting wood for railway ties. That was really a big job. And transporting them and moving them and building. Railways were always being built. And not just railway links from here to there, but in and around the docks. The railway lines going into the elevators, into the freight sheds, and so on. So there's lots of railway buildings.
Mm-hmm. The Italians, the Slovaks, the Baltic peoples, where would they would end up in the freight yards mainly?
The Italians would end up in the freight yards. And maybe the other central or southern Europeans. There were a lot of Greeks in the freight yards before the First World War. And they were the most inflammatory of all when it came to the strikes. Then there was these Balkan Wars. A lot of them went off to fight in the Balkan Wars. 1913, and didn't come back. And at one point, the CPR decided they weren't going to hire any more Greeks anyway, because they were often at the center of some labor dispute.
Do you have any thought for why? Whether that was actually... a fair reputation, and what about Greek workers that made them that much more volatile?
The Greeks, I don't know if it was something to do with their hate to categorize people by characteristics, you know, passionate Italians and Doer Scots and that kind of thing. But there are certainly many real issues by the way work was done and managed in the freight yard. So I think they had very much right to be angered.
Tell us about the working conditions of various laborers. And would it be fair to say that you could extrapolate those conditions to, you know, if somebody was doing bull labor in the construction of elevators, that the conditions would be pretty much the same?
Well, after the unions or the construction on the elevators was unionized, you know, there were so many hours of work and you could get overtime after so much, so there was a bit more control. I did have an interview with someone who'd been a freight handler later, and evidently work depended on when the ship came in. So when the ship came in, there was no union hall as there is today, where you go in and you know there's a proper lineup. Then the workers would all rush down to the dock and they would fight one another to get into the line. And this one person still had his injuries from such a fight. So you might work 15 hours straight in the summer when daylight hours were long. So it was pretty rough going with, and then all the lifting, heavy, heavy lifting. And they started at a very young age, probably 15, 14. And then you have to fight little twerps, fighting big, hulking men. So it was sort of a violent kind of thing, and people were divided, of course, by nationality, too. Nationalities tended to cling together and be out. Probably the Greeks and Italians didn't get along, I don't know.
So in modern day language, then, would we have the equivalent of gangs?
No, all that work is done through the unions. It's all organized.
No, but I'm thinking of socially, you know, and the dislike of one group for another. Would it be sort of the equivalent of urban gangs?
I don't think so.
Violence and...
urban gangs, those people seem to be unemployed youth today with nothing to do. These people had lots to do. And at night they'd be either too tired to do much, or if they had any energy, they'd go off to the local bar. The bootlegging was quite prevalent, too. And there are two wonderful documents that someone gave me when I started my research. The Methodist and Presbyterian churches did social surveys. They meant to do them of all towns in Ontario, and whether they did any others, but they did one of Port Arthur and one of Fort William. So one of the things they have is a list of all the reasons people were arrested and charged, all the different crimes. One, it's really sad to look, one of them, a crime was to attempt suicide. That was a crime. A crime was being insane. a crime was driving furiously. That was after the car came in 1912 or so, driving furiously or recklessly, probably going up to 10 or 15 miles an hour.
What years were those, do you recall?
13, 14.
Okay, well, that'd be interesting reading.
Yeah, I have copies, and the museum has copies.
Okay, yeah.
They're fascinating, actually.
Oh, I bet
lots
they would
on
be.
The social history, and the social history in the immigrant areas, and how the sort of upper middle class lived. One place they divide Port Arthur into three classes. One is the sort of middle class, then the upper levels of the working class, the aristocrats of labor, and then the unskilled working, immigrant working class.
Hmm. Who were the major employers at the time?
Well, the railways, the grain elevators. I don't know when the shipyards came in. They were big. That would be in these books.
Mm-hmm. Did corporations, businesses, employers, did they themselves have reputations for being like good socially conscious employees or employers versus ones that were sort of you worked
CPR,
for them but you didn't want to?
CPR certainly had a bad reputation because and not only with the immigrants, but with the ordinary, you know, the railway worker. There were lots of terrible strikes. And their ambition was, of course, to make more money. And they didn't treat their workers very well. They had a habit, maybe somebody working for the railway and then be approaching retirement. They'd let them go a couple of months before retirement, make them not eligible for their pensions. That was not unusual.
And that would have been
well,
into the
into
mid-century.
The 40s.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. There were three... railways, at least connected to the grain trade, operating the Canadian Northern, the Grand Trunk, and the CPR. Were they all pretty much the same in the way they treated their employees?
I'm not sure about the Grand Trunk. It came in a bit later. I think in the early days, the CPR was probably the worst. There were a couple of strikes on the Canadian Northern down here at the waterfront. And they tried to organize them into a union. And the name of the person who did that was Lachlan Torrey, T-O-R-R-I-E. And I didn't know till even after I finished my thesis that he was the uncle of one of my friends. He ended up being the reeve of over the township out near South Gillies. They lived out in that area. A very respected veteran of the First World War, but he certainly was hated by the Canadian Northern.
Mm.
Yeah, the British in that strike, they were mostly complained. We were always led to believe that Britons are all free, no matter where the Union Jack flag flies, but that is not the case with the CPR.
Do you have any speculation or even more solid reasons for why the CPR was the way it was?
Well, they were not, they were typical. If you look at labor history in the U.S. with the railways, the Carnegies, the big fights. I mean, this is, they called these people the robber barons. They were, if you look at their lifestyles, it was just over the top the way these people lived. They wanted money and they had no regards. They were all respectable churchgoers, of course. But the four, I mean, even I was, you know, brought up in sort of a middle-class family, but the foreigners weren't, you know, they weren't really British, something to be frowned upon.
I find that interesting because of all of the government assistance that an organization that the CPR got.
Yes,
from taxpayers' dollars that right. It would have allowed to be so irresponsible.
But the government represented the railways. I mean, they were there to serve the railways, really. And many of them were made senators or had big positions in government. Now, William Lyon Mackenzie King came along, although he'd worked for the Rockefellers in the States, but he tried to bring in sort of mediation in labor disputes, and he brought that in. And he had a bit more of a social conscience.
How are we doing for time here? Oh, geez. Can we take a little bit of a break?
Would you like more coffee?
Are we ready to
continue? Ready to rock and roll?
Yeah.
Here we go. One, two, three, go.
There are a few things that I wanted to pull out from Labor Pains. And you've referred to conditions that people were working under. But we really didn't get into the labor strife. So what do you think pushed people sort of over the edge into being unhappy enough to strike, and in certain instances those strikes did not go very well? So tell us a bit about the sort of highlights of the labor unrest.
Well, with the freight handlers, I think it had to do with wages. And there is something called the bonus system, where if some freight handlers started working at the beginning of the shipping season and stayed till the very end, he'd get an extra bonus. Now, many of these freight handlers who were not married would go back to Italy for the winter. You know, the shipping third class or whatever, passenger fares were dirt cheap and they could afford it, so they didn't like the bonus system. They wanted that money incorporated into their wages. And they, I think they wanted to be treated with a sense of dignity. And in the case of the street railwaymen strike. All of the street railwaymen, of course, were Anglo types. It was largely a case of unfairness, where one of their workers had been forced to drive his streetcar overtime during another strike of the coal handlers, and he was just so tired he didn't think he could do it, and so he was fired outright. And with the coal handlers, again, it was a question of wages. And I think also they were human beings and they wanted to treat like human beings and with a sense of dignity. And so the ability to organize and feel the strength of unity with others gave them that sense of dignity and the fact that they could stand up to the big boss. Now, at the beginning of labor pains, as you mentioned, there are many in the middle classes who empathized with the workers in their strikes, partly because the workers were their customers, and partly because many of them had working class origins themselves. And but towards the end of that, when certain segments of the working class were becoming very radicalized politically, I think the lingo of the left sort of frightened them. It was this, the Finns especially, and then some labor leaders who came in from outside and would give inflammatory speeches. So they certainly wanted to get rid of, it was sort of like the Red Scare before there were Reds. So that ended up with a big division in Thunder Bay's society, where at one time there were sort of all of Thunder Bay against the CPR. But that changed.
How would the typical early strike situation play out?
Well, when Harry Bryan came, he had been well trained in how strikes are conducted in the U.S. He knew, he set up an office, he had an agenda, he had people appointed to do things. And one of the things he said in advice to the strikers, you know, don't indulge in rabid language. Your aim is to make allies in the rest of the labor, in the rest of society. I haven't got his right words, but that was the essence of what he said. But by the end, the rest of society was got rather hostile. I don't think when the street railway was shut down and the cars were driven by scabs, it was so tense. I think this alienated most people because hardly anyone went anywhere by car in those days. Everybody had to use the street railway.
How did the CPR, because it was likely the biggest employer initially anyway, how did they deal with strikes?
Well, the CPR, first of all, had its own, and they still do, railways still have their own police forces. So they brought in CPR police, but they also, since they had the trains, they could bring in strike breakers by train, either from Winnipeg or from Montreal. So in one strike, they brought in all these Italians to go into the freight sheds, but all the strikers met the train and told them what was going on, so they decided not to join, not to work for the CPR. But the next time they were able to take the train right into the freight shed area without meeting anyone, and was able to set them to work. So they had power in that sense. And in 1909, there was a shootout right where the monument is to the original fort at the foot of McTavish. It's now called McNaughton Street, but it used to be McIntyre Street. Right where the monument is, there was a shootout. And one CPR policeman later died of his wounds. It's amazing that no one else did. So then, that's when, yes, it now comes back to me. Here we are. Colonel Steele, founder of the RCMP and hero of the Boer War, just happened to be in town to expect the local militia. So he called in the Royal Canadian Mounted Rifles to the East End, and they quickly were able to bring about law and order. And the CPR, I think this is right, the CPR sent the military a bill for transportation of men to quell their own strike.
So if you were if you were a judgmental person, who were the good guys and who were the bad guys in these labor?
Well, there.
What could either side have done to make things a little less volatile?
Well, there were many people in the middle who were really good guys who tried to mediate. And one was Frederick Urey, who was an architect from Britain, who founded a member of the Carpenters Union, who founded the Port Arthur Trades and Labor Council, active member at St. Paul's, then Presbyterian Church, founded the Brotherhood Movement, and he acted as a mediator. He also ran once for the Socialist Party and then for the Independent Labor Party, founded a labor paper called The Wage Earner. So he, the people on the far left didn't like him, of course, because he was in the middle, and he was certainly hated by 1913 by the mayor of Port Arthur because he was trying to do right by the workers.
And the mayor of Port Arthur wasn't keen on the workers being done right by?
Well, no. Not at that time, after the street railway, he thought of Urey as an agitator. Then in Fort William, there's L.L. Pelche. As I mentioned, he'd been in the Order of Railway Conductors, became a councillor, and then mayor for two sessions. He was mayor during this 1909 strike where the firing took place. So he was hated by the labor because he thought, he did read the Riot Act, which enabled the militia to be called out, but he also wanted to bring about peace, and he was in a bind. People like that are always in a bind. And so he was quite remarkable. He was really a big L liberal, although he certainly sided with the workers. But the bad guys, I don't know if you can put it that way. It was a social situation which was, I think, repeated all throughout the world at that time. I mean, North Europe was, you know, on the brink of World War I and the Soviet Revolution, so things were far more inflammatory. Mm. In the United States, there were some terrible labor disputes going on. So I think really the big corporations, and in fact, most of society being non-immigrant, were not that sympathy to the plight of these strange people. You had the social gospel movement taking place where they thought the solution was to Canadianize all these people. So the Methodist Church set up something in the East End called a place for schooling, giving manual training lessons and English lessons to immigrant children, trying to help them out. And according to somebody I interviewed, the priests did not approve of their good Catholic children going off to something run by these Protestants.
So what was the role of the churches in the whole thing, other than what you just mentioned?
I think it was varied. The Finns, of course, many of them, as I said, came out as revolutionaries and not religious. They were the non-church Finns, so the two Finn halls. The big Finn hall was founded by the socialist Finns, and the little Finn hall beside it originally was the publishing house of the socialist Finns. It was only after the Soviet Revolution that the split amongst the socialists took place, and the red Finns got the little Finn hall and the non-red Finns got the big Finn hall. But and the rest of the Finns, the religious Finns, were all Lutheran. And the animosity between these church Finns and non-church Finns before the war was quite intense.
Did that also, was that reflected in any way in where they worked?
Like,
in where they worked? Like, did the religious Finns work in one place and the normalists work in another?
I wouldn't think so.
No? Okay. And the Protestant churches, like you'd mentioned the social study that had been done by the
These were the national bodies of the churches. So the originals of these documents are in the United Church Archives right now. And then St. Paul's Presbyterian Church, because of Frederick Urey and a minister they had, Reverend Murray, there was something called the Brotherhood Movement, and where the idea was to bring the Brotherhood. Don't wait till you get to heaven for social justice. Your idea is to bring the kingdom of God to earth, not don't wait till you get to heaven. So they had a lot of meetings and gatherings. In fact, the founding meeting of the Port Arthur Trades and Labor Council took place at St. Paul's Presbyterian Church. And then that meeting, it's in here, was disrupted by a printer named Leo T. English, who was a socialist, who got up and bawled them all out for being a bunch of hypocrites. Now, I don't know that much about the role of the Catholic Church in the East End, but as you probably know, Roy Puivasana has written a lot on the East End and the role of the church.
A couple of things came out, I felt, that struck me in here, in your book, Labor Pains. One was, although a lot of those Central European, Southern European immigrants were illiterate in English.
What?
Illiterate in English.
Yeah.
The quality of the speakers, the debates, the conversations that went on, the people who showed up at various meetings seemed to be quite beyond what you would think.
Now, you would get that with the Finns. The Finns in Finland were brought up as Protestant and literate. And over in North America, they had a lively printing press. That's why they built the Little Finn Hall. They had a daily for a while that went right across the country. They imported left-wing publications from the States. They were well-read, and so was the English work or British working class. They were well-read. You wouldn't get that too much amongst the Italians or Greeks. So there was one person who became a spokesman of the Italian freight handlers. But he was never, I don't think he was ever a freight handler.
He was the fellow from Winnipeg or got training in Manitoba?
Yes, and then he ended up in Detroit or Chicago. Gosh, his name.
And he was brought in because he could speak?
Yeah, he was representing.
Italian.
And he was Italian. But
if that had been done earlier, do you think, would
that
have helped?
No, I don't think so. He would often, when Italians were in court for something like disorderly conduct or something, he would often represent them in court. But I think that was, and that's why the Italians in the East End types tended to vote liberal. Whereas the Finnish, of course, voted either for the Independent Labour Party when it came on the scene, which was the forerunner of the CCF-NDP, or for the Socialists. And the Socialists had a little flurry here, but they could never beat the Conservative, J.J. Carrick, who founded Maraday Park, was the mayor, the member of parliament, and ran one of the daily newspapers.
You're talking about newspapers. That was another thing I found fascinating in the period that your book covers, is just how much labor was covered in the newspapers.
Incredible. And it's unfortunate that the liberal paper, the Chronicle, there's hardly a copy of it left, whereas there's a complete run, I think, of the Daily News, when the Conservative, but they were so pithy, all their comments. I think it sold papers, for one thing. And at one time, they would want to court the Labour vote. It was quite interesting.
And did that change when the attitude started to change too, when people got a bit more afraid?
So.
Yeah. We're running near the end of our time, so I'm not sure how much, like this, your labor pains ended before the First World War,
yes,
right?
Right.
Did you Just out of interest, did you follow what happened with the labor related to the railway and grain trade?
Well, I tried to find out from the grain handlers, and I talked to Frank Mazur, who was head of the grain handlers union in the, 1880s and so? 70s and 80s. About their documents. I think they may have donated some of their documents to the museum. But certainly, as I recall, even when I came here, the grain handlers were big. Of course, I don't know if it was on the Port Arthur site or there were 1,500 employees. How many are there now? Hardly any.
200.
Yeah. The union was strong. They were always going, not always, but had many strikes. Frank Mazur was the most hated man on the prairies because the one strike, they would, farmers would lose $10 million a day from the strike. So then when I found this article about automation and Cargill, that's what it's about. There's all these strikes encouraged automation in the grain elevators, so you wouldn't need as many workers.
Mm. One thing I'll just mention, because course of doing our interviews, we've interviewed a lot of management people who were involved in negotiations with Frank Mazur. They all spoke extremely highly of him.
Oh, did they?
And said
did.
That he was very fair.
Oh, that's wonderful.
And they said direct and fair, and he had a job to do, and we
that's
had a job
it.
To do.
Yeah.
But I don't, from what you said, that certainly didn't translate into what the ordinary farmer may have thought.
No, because
of the,
they felt the effect.
Yes. They also mentioned that... in comparison to carrying on negotiations with the West Coast, dealing with Thunder Bay was a much easier task.
Oh, isn't that interesting?
It is very interesting, yes, yeah. I thought. So for those of you listening in, if you want to talk to some of the elevator management people or listen to those tapes of the elevator manager people, it's interesting to see the difference in perception.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Anything you'd like to add to what we've talked about?
I don't think so. I am so far removed from this. The book came out in 2009, but most of my research was done in the 1970s. I would like to say that in 1972, I think it was. Yes. I organized something called the Thunder Bay Labor History Interview Project, even though I wasn't a youth that was funded by the... Opportunities for Youth program, a federal government program to give employment to young people. So we had a team of interviewers, and we'd go around and interview people who'd worked, or even some of the people who had been managerial types. So there are three interviews here, which I think would be really important for your project to take a look at. And one is Gilbert Otway, who is a grain trimmer and son of a grain trimmer. One is James Dillon, who talks about in 1934 an attempt to organize an independent union in the grain elevators. The other is John Mazur, father of Frank, who was worked in 1925 in a grain elevator. And another was Ken McKenzie, a Scottish stonemason, who actually worked on the construction of the Port Arthur Collegiate. It's all stone. But evidently, he worked for 31 years as a wayman in the elevators. So I don't have copies of those, but those tapes are available either at the university or Conn College. So if somebody...
I tried to track them down at Conn College because we had talked about this before when I'd chatted
with
you.
Did they have them?
Nobody could find them. But I'm hoping that, I think that Tory Tronard might have them at the
he
museum.
He might have them, the museum, the university.
University
does.
Northern Studies? Okay.
And there's a whole set of them in the National Archives in Ottawa.
Perfect.
If they have anyone left on their staff.
You said, Jean, that you interviewed a number of grain trimmers earlier in the interview here. Are those the people that you were speaking of?
Yes, this Otway is in particular.
Mm-hmm. You also mentioned that you interviewed Frank Mazur, but you didn't tape that interview?
No, I talked to him many times. Okay. I would see him here and there.
And what would you say defined him in your mind?
He was strong, he was principled. In some ways, he was a typical labor boss. He was a big man, commanding. You knew he was in the room when he came in. And he was not only tall, but quite big. He was a genuine person, I would say. Yeah.
And what was his, Mazur is what? Nationality would have been
I
his.
Think they're Ukrainian.
Okay.
Maybe it was Mazursky or something originally.
Yeah, right.
I'm pretty sure.
Yeah.
That would come out in this.
Mm-hmm. Anything else, Monica?
Harry Bryan. You brought up his name.
Yes.
Is it Bryan or Bryan?
B-R-Y-A-N.
Oh, thank you. That's what I thought. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yes, he was a big personality. At the time.
He was a strike organizer or union organizer.
Union organizer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he was big in the, after the First World War, in the lumber workers' strikes, and one of the founding mm-hmm. members of the Communist Party of Canada. And he has descendants in Thunder Bay.
The... article that you sent me this morning
on Cargill
outlined the sort of case study of labor management relations in early 2000s, I guess. It would have been farther back.
A bit before.
Yeah.
I just scanned it quickly. Mm-hmm. I came across it by accident on Google.
Yeah. Did you scan it well enough to say how it fits in or compares to early labor relations to that rather civilized, sounded like, interaction of the civilized perhaps, but no less, to my mind anyway, no less important to how things were unfolding and changing?
Well, the reason it came up because I Googled Frank Mazur's name and he's in it. And the negotiations, it was at the time when there was a lot of labor dispute and a big workforce. So Cargill is in the business of making money. So anything to lower labor costs is good. So I think it's about why they went ahead with automation, and there's a lot of technical stuff in it about how they did that, which, as I said, I think I spent about 5 minutes scanning the article, so I really can't speak on it authoritatively.
I think that's it, and it's been a wonderful interview, as I knew it would be. Thank you so much. I've listened to you speak, and amazing to me what your mind manages to hold, and how you're able to speak about it so nice and clearly.
Well, thank you.
What I took from the Labor Pains book was what a special place Thunder Bay was.
It's amazing, isn't it? It really is.
Yeah.
Know whether this kind of thing was going on all over?
Well, not to the same extent, because two things that you mentioned in your book. One is the person who made the comment, and I can't remember who it was, or was it a Toronto newspaper, that said it was the most cosmopolitan city in North America?
That's right.
So would you like to say something about that? Why was it the most cosmopolitan city?
Well, I think it's because of the great diversity of ethnic groups. That was probably it.
Yeah. The other thing that I found interesting was their comment about how all of the undesirables, or ethnics, as terms were used at the time, had been moved out of the port cities on the U.S. side and may have come to settle in Thunder Bay.
I think.
Except for they kept a few. They kept a couple. I don't know if it was the Finnish or the... they didn't
they
sort of blackball
over.
Duluth they would.
That's right. They'd bring them up and dump them, and this annoyed the labor unions because they were there to provide cheaper labor than they were willing to provide.
Yeah. It was ever so. Thanks very much.
You're welcome. I hope that I just felt I wasn't.
Oh,
quote.
No, before you do, you were going to read the words of a song
to us.
Do
you want me?
Yes, please. Now, what is this in?
This is in a song called the Northern Ontario Pioneer Marching Song, an invitation, words and music by Charles Alexander Mack, 50 cents, and someone gave it to me.
Who published it? Does it say?
Whaley Boyer and Company Limited, 237 Yonge Street, Toronto, printed for the composer.
And on the front is a picture of... Oh, my goodness, a grain elevator.
Of a grain elevator. So here's some of the words. There is a part of Fair Canada by the gateway from east to west, and citizens living in it loudly proclaim advantages there are the best. On Great Lake Superior's northern coast, this fortunate land does lay and stretches far to the distant inland shores of old historic Hudson Bay. New Ontario, the land around the gateway to the great Canadian West, New Ontario, where producers for the prairies find location is the best. New Ontario, between Lake Superior and Hudson Bay, do not hesitate. Thoroughly investigate. For dear welcome stranger, many who have done so have decided to stay. And it goes on and on. Oh, here's the music. And here's
more elevators.
Some of the grain elevators. storage capacity 55 million bushels and constantly being increased.
Does it say what date? Did we get that?
That's what I'm trying to find out.
Well, at least, you know, we can we can go back to the capacity of that time.
And yeah.
Price.
So, do you want to take this?
Oh, do birds fly?
Okay, I just wonder if I give you anything, if I could have a receipt for it sometime.
Oh, yeah. Well, who knows when, but... Actually, what you could do is...
Could I put a sticker on the back?
I'd like you to put a sticker on and tell me to return it, and then when you're you know, downsizing... because what I'd like to do is scan them in.
Okay.
But we don't have our... Monica, you might as well turn this off now.
Oh, Hugh McMillan gave me this.